Welcome.
Welcome to the North Carolina Reading Service. Today is Tuesday. Yes, it is all day. August 27th, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, we bring news and information from around the world, country, state, and triangle to listeners who are blind and print impaired. Our broadcasts are received from Wilmington to Winston-Salem over specially tuned radio receivers and via the internet at ncreadingservice.org. All news is read as printed, and in our first hour, we'll cover news, editorials, and comments of statewide interest. Your readers today are Tim Mannix and...
I think it's Steve Lord. I'm not quite sure. My ears are blown out here.
You look at him, I think he's not sure. Anyway, we're going to test him. We're going to try and start and see if he can take you through today's front page from the NNO and then give you a weather report. Good luck.
I'll try. Thanks, Tim. Across the top of the NNO today, there's a story from sports that's teased. We'll cover that in our noon hour. Canales has five things on his mind in finalizing a roster. I'm not sure if I pronounced that right. C-A-N-A-L-E-S, Canales. And there is a teaser for a story that we may find time to cover. Find a variety of viewpoints and editorials on the most important topic of the day. Okay, no. Headline from the NNO. Person County residents question Dominion gas plant permit. Down the right-hand column, Durham School of Arts to leave downtown for a new campus. And at the bottom of the page, Josh Stein, current attorney general and candidate for governor, proposes tax-free holiday and free student meals. All those three stories coming up in our first half hour. Your forecast for this Tuesday? Well, we're hotter and more humid with mostly sunny skies today. Highs in the mid to upper 90s. We're looking for 97 here in Raleigh today. Heat index approaching the lower 100s. Summer has come back. This is the start of an excessive heat stretch that will last all week and then back off this weekend as a cold front descends in from the north, bringing scattered showers and storms for the Labor Day weekend. Today, we could be rivaling the old record high at RDU, which is 98, set back in 2016. Overnight, mostly clear skies and warmer, lows in the upper 60s to low 70s. Then, again, 98 for Wednesday, 98 for Thursday, 95 for Friday, with a chance of rain and thunderstorms, 94 for Saturday, 91 for Sunday.
Hey, by the way, great recovery. Josh Stein proposes tax-free holiday and free student meals. North Carolina hasn't offered a taxed holiday in a decade, but Democratic gubernatorial nominee Josh Stein says he wants to revive the idea. Stein, the current attorney general, announced his plan last week to implement a tax-free weekend, giving teachers stipends for school supplies and provide free meals to all North Carolina public school students if he's elected governor. The state had an August tax-free weekend for 11 years until former Republican Governor Pat McCrory and the Republican-controlled legislature cut it in 2014 as part of a larger plan that reduced individual income tax in North Carolina. Stein says that the back-to-school tax cuts are just one part of his plan to alleviate high costs of living for North Carolina families. We can do more than one thing at a time, he said at a news conference at Central Piedmont Community College in Charlotte. This is a concrete proposal that will help families who are stretching their budgets during the month before school starts to be able to afford just a little bit more. During tax-free holidays, families can buy certain school supplies, often including clothes and computers, without having to pay sales tax. In Mecklenburg and Wake counties, this means saving 7.25% on an item. Sales taxes range from 6.75% to 7.5% across North Carolina. In Mecklenburg County, a family spending $100 all on qualified school supplies could save $7.25 on taxes compared to a normal weekend. The savings for taxes also means less revenue for state government. In 2012, the state lost around $13.6 million in revenue from the tax holiday, according to a previous Charlotte Observer. The spokesperson for Republican Lieutenant Governor Mark Robinson's campaign for governor called the proposal a cheap election year stunt. Stein is a far-left career politician who has been voting for higher taxes and wasteful spending for years. The same failed policies that drive the crippling inflation that makes it more expensive for families getting ready to go back to school, Mike Lonergan wrote in a statement to The Observer. Proponents of the holiday say it helps families save money and supports business while boosting the economy. Stein says North Carolina residents travel to neighboring states with a tax-free weekend, including South Carolina and Tennessee, to do their back-to-school shopping. A representative from the North Carolina Retail Merchants Association told the Charlotte Observer in 2013 the tax-free holiday created a massive boost in income for retailers each year. In 2015, representatives from South Park and North Lake Malls told The Observer many stores would offer discounts in lieu of the holiday in order to attract back-to-school shoppers. But critics say tax-free holidays are nothing more than flashy political tactics that distract from more substantial tax reforms that could be more beneficial. A 2024 article from the Tax Foundation, a nonpartisan tax policy nonprofit, says the holidays do not increase school year shopping done at local stores. Instead, they consolidate shopping that would otherwise be done across many weeks to just one weekend. It also said the conversation regarding tax-free weekends often ignores the burden sales tax may place on people all year. Across the county, 19 states will hold it. That must be country. 19 states will hold at least one tax-free holiday in 2024, according to the Tax Foundation. In South Carolina, there's not as much buzz around tax-free weekend today as there was when it was implemented back in 2000, said Sherry East, the president of the South Carolina Education Association. But stores are still busy, she said, and she occasionally avoids shopping the holiday because of crowds. I do think it's a benefit to our families here in South Carolina, and it's kind of a marketing tool to get people out because you may or may not get all tax-free items. He says there's been more debate recently in South Carolina about whether tax-free holidays are beneficial for the state. But for the average family, she said, the weekend can be a good way to save. McGrory told The Observer a tax-free weekend revival not attached to a comprehensive plan can be a gimmick. I think it ought to be combined as a package, he says. Is it part of a total plan with an overall strategy, or a just limited appeal to a certain segment of voters and to get a lot of free publicity? In addition to a tax-free weekend, Stein proposed a yearly $300 stipend for teachers who, he said, are spending their own money buying school supplies like crayons and glue sticks for their classrooms. Stein also said he'd offer free meals to every public school student in the state, making sure children have access to nutritious, locally sourced foods during the school day. Public education is not a Republican issue. It's not a Democratic issue. It's not a concern of independent voters alike. It's a North Carolina issue, he said. It's time we stand up for North Carolina's children.
Person County residents question Dominion gas plant permit. From Helena Moriah Road, the planned site of the Moriah Energy Center disappears up a dirt driveway and behind a large dirt mound. Nearby residents and environmental groups are worried about the air pollution that will float over that dirt and into homes along the rural Person County roads if Dominion Energy is allowed to move forward with a planned liquefied natural gas storage facility on the site near Rougemount. Dominion plans to build the facility in two phases, with a pair of towering tanks capable of holding up to 25 million gallons of liquefied natural gas, or gas that is cooled down to extremely low temperatures in order to be shrunk and stored more easily. When the gas is needed, Dominion would heat it back up and inject it into a nearby pipeline. with the gas in each tank expanding to as much as 2 billion cubic feet. The company is seeking a minor air permit from the North Carolina Department of Air Quality, the final approval Dominion needs before it can start construction on the Moriah Energy Center. Emissions come when the facility is heating and cooling gas, but also when it burns off the non-methane chemicals that are removed before the gas is cooled. Dominion's calculations of its air pollution likely underestimate how much formaldehyde, acrolein, and other toxins will be emitted from the natural gas facility, a coalition of more than a dozen environmental groups told DAQ in a comment letter. Some of those undercounts could be so significant, they said, that Dominion should be required to seek a more stringent air permit and conduct constant monitoring around the plant. During a public hearing in early August, dozens of residents from Person County and nearby Durham urged the Department of Air Quality to reject Dominion's permit. If nothing else, they said, the company should be monitoring the air. I was shocked to learn that regular air quality monitoring is not a requirement for this facility. People just assume that air pollution monitoring will be in place to ensure compliance with standards, Julie Nye, who lives a mile from the site, said at a hearing, before asking for robust, ongoing monitoring if the permit is not denied. Formaldehyde is one of the chemicals environmental groups are particularly concerned about. It was one of four air pollutants for which DAQ required Dominion to model concentrations, along with acrolein, benzene, and hexane. All four are toxic. Dominion had to show its emissions would keep air concentrations in surrounding communities below levels considered dangerous. For formaldehyde, that ambient air level is 150 parts per million, averaged over a one-hour period. Dominion's modeling showed its emissions will peak at 116 parts per million over that time frame. But environmental groups say modeling frequently underestimates toxic air pollutants. If trends hold at the Moriah Energy Center, they told DAQ, formaldehyde and other chemicals could actually be at unsafe concentrations around the Dominion facility. There are two air monitors that measure formaldehyde from North Carolina industrial facilities. Representatives from groups like Appalachian Voices, the Blue Ridge Environmental Defense League, the Environmental Defense Fund, and the Person County Community Action Network noted it in a comment letter. Those monitors have measured formaldehyde concentrations that are 1.4 and 1.8 times higher than the maximum shown in the model for nearby facilities, while national data indicates that formaldehyde emissions are usually twice as high as models show. If Dominion's formaldehyde emissions are higher by the same proportion as the other two North Carolina facilities, the Moriah Energy Center would cause concentrations in nearby air to be out of compliance with federal standards. Formaldehyde is a probable human carcinogen, according to the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, with exposure linked to lung and nasopharyngeal cancer. Exposure to high levels of the chemical can cause coughing, wheezing, and irritations of the eyes and throat. To ensure that ambient air levels remain within acceptable ranges and protect neighboring communities, the environmental groups asked DAQ to require that Dominion pay for third-party monitoring for acrolein and formaldehyde, specifically at the facility's border and in the surrounding community. We recommend air monitoring be used as a way to ground truth modeling data, the groups wrote in a joint public comment letter. We understand that this is typically required in a response to violations of a facility's permit, but waiting until the community has already been polluted and exposed is unacceptable in our view. Dominion insists that its models are based on technical data required by North Carolina air quality officials, who then signed off on the company's estimates. Dominion Energy is confident in its air dispersion modeling, which was conducted in accordance with NCDEQ regulations and was submitted to the agency for verification. The modeling demonstrates that the Moriah Energy Center would operate below acceptable ambient levels, which have been established to be protective of human health, Priscita Montanez, a Dominion Energy spokeswoman, wrote in an email. In August, researchers from Cornell University, the Environmental Defense Fund, and the University of Oklahoma published a peer-review study that found measured benzene levels near refineries were between 3 and 95 times higher than model predictions, based on self-reported emissions during unplanned releases at 14 Texas refineries between 2019 and 2022. When there are discrepancies between measured and modeled concentration, that means either the models themselves are flawed, or information such as emissions that is being put into the model is inaccurate. Libby Moore, the Environmental Defense Fund's petrochemicals team senior data analyst and one of the study's authors, told the NNO. The latter could stem from using flawed methodologies to estimate emissions of a given chemical from a given activity. While models are never perfect, we continue to find more and more evidence that emissions are being underestimated in many cases, and that this plays a substantial role in observed discrepancies between measured and modeled pollution levels, Moore said in an email. The Brea Energy Center is one of several new natural gas facilities planned for Person County. Dominion is also proposing crossing the county with a new pipeline, although Montana's has consistently said that the new pipeline would not connect with the gas storage facility. Dominion's pipeline would include a leg running north of the shore of Hyco Lake, where Duke Energy is proposing closing a coal-fired power plant and replacing it with a pair of gas-fired plants. Environmental groups have expressed concerns about all of the projects. They note that methane, the primary component of natural gas, is a potent greenhouse gas, even if it doesn't last as long in the atmosphere as carbon dioxide. Sierra Club estimates found that the use of natural gas from the Brea Energy Center could cause greenhouse gas emissions equivalent to 1.3 million tons of carbon dioxide, or the annual emissions of about 264,000 gas-powered cars. At a time when we need to quickly transition away from fossil fuels, the Brea Energy Center and related gas projects put us further down the road to climate hell, the environmental groups wrote in their public comment letter. Another comment focused on the flare Dominion is proposing to use to burn off chemicals that are removed from the gas before it is cooled. Ron Sehu, an environmental engineering consultant working for the Environmental Integrity Project, told DAQ that Dominion's application says the flares will be 98% efficient at burning those chemicals off. But that can change quickly based on winds and chemicals in the so-called waste gas, which can impact a flare's speed and temperature. Increasing emissions from the flares could quickly result in the facility having more emissions than allowed under the permit, including of carbon monoxide. Dominion's draft permit says the facility is capable of 95.76 tons of carbon monoxide emissions annually. At 100 tons, Dominion would need to seek a major permit. We note that small changes in control efficiency have a drastic effect on the emissions. For example, a drop from 98% to 97% in the control efficiency results in a 50% increase in the calculated emissions. This is simply how the math works, Sehu wrote. Only by constantly monitoring, Sehu argued, will DAQ be able to ensure that Dominion is remaining within the bounds of its requested permit. The public comment period has closed, and DAQ is now considering the application.
Durham School of the Arts to leave downtown for a new campus. On the first day of school Monday, students streaming into Durham School of the Arts before the 8:30 a.m. bell knew this was one of the last years they'd be on the historic downtown campus. The Durham School Board voted unanimously Thursday night to close the school and build a replacement several miles away. It'll have more classrooms, better art facilities, and be big enough to serve hundreds more students. Elena, a seventh grader, would have preferred a renovation so she could stay immersed in downtown despite the aging buildings. "I like it here," she said, after petting her dog Ferguson through the open passenger window and saying goodbye to her dad. "I can walk to get food." DSA is a middle and high school, so Elena will spend her high school years on the new campus if construction goes according to plan. The new school is scheduled to open in 2026. "The new location is not ideal, in my opinion. It's not walkable," her dad, Dylan Shepherd, said. After the new college-esque campus was first approved in late 2023, Opponents mounted a last-ditch effort against the move, citing the ballooning cost, at least $241 million, and the value of having arts students in downtown, historic downtown. But school board member Natalie Beyer said building a new art school was clearly the will of the voters, who in 2022 approved a school construction bond with 83% of the vote. DSA was the premier item, at the time projected to use a quarter of the $425 million raised. Now, DSA will take more than half of the money, putting off renovations for several elementary schools. From what I heard, it's overpacked, and the facilities are pretty outdated, said Jane Dorneman, who was with her husband Monday, walking their 11-year-old child to the first day of sixth grade. With the way we underfund our schools, I can't imagine they'd do this if it wasn't really necessary, she said. The school's current brick campus is on nearly 17 acres on the edge of downtown, sandwiched between North Duke and North Gregson streets, with nowhere to grow. The oldest of the eight buildings was constructed in 1922. A consultant said that 3 years ago it was unsafe, outdated, and tied up traffic at pickup and drop-off times. Over a decade ago, the school system paid $4.1 million for the 57-acre property on Duke Homestead Road, where DSA will move. The property is about 3.5 miles on the north side of Interstate 85. Moving is likely simpler but pricier than a renovation, which consultants projected earlier this year would run $216 million and require shrinking the student body for several years. Frederick Davis II, the district's director of building services, said it could quickly become a money pit. The new campus will have a capacity for 2,295 middle and high school students compared to the 1,800 served today. It's a magnet school with admissions determined entirely by lottery. No plans have been solidified for the downtown campus once the school moves, but district leaders say they will not sell the property. I'd love to see us reinvent that as a shared space for all of our students moving forward, Chair Millicent Rogers said earlier this month.
Russia hits Ukraine with over 100 missiles targeting energy. Ukraine said Russia fired more than 100 missiles and nearly as many drones at cities across the country on Monday in a massive attack against power infrastructure that caused blackouts and left at least 3 people dead. The energy sector has sustained significant damage, President Volodymyr Zelensky said in a post on the X social media network, calling the strike one of the largest since the Kremlin's invasion of his country began more than 2 years ago. Russia has been stepping up efforts to knock out Ukraine's civilian infrastructure, including power, heating, and water supplies, ahead of the winter season. The latest attack comes as Kyiv continues its incursion in the Kursk region of Russia, which caught Moscow off guard and has prompted tens of thousands of residents to flee their homes. Russia's defense ministry said on Monday it targeted gas compressor stations in western Ukraine, as well as electric substations and air missile storages across the country. The attacks affected 15 of Ukraine's 27 regions, Foreign Minister Dmytro Kuleba said in a post on X, including the capital of Kyiv and the western Lviv region near the border with Poland. The capital's hydropower plant was among the targets. Emergency power and water supply cuts were imposed in Kyiv. The barrage prompted Zelensky to again call on Ukraine's western allies to remove limits on the use of long-range weapons to hit military targets inside Russia and deliver more air defenses and missiles. Our defenders cannot be restricted in their weapons when Russia deploys its entire arsenal, including Shaheds and ballistic missiles from North Korea, he said in the post. America, Britain, France, and our other partners have the power to help us stop this terror. One of the Russian drones entered Polish airspace early on Monday and disappeared from radar around 15.5 miles deep into its territory. A search operation was on to find the object. Polish and NATO jets were scrambled to safeguard the country's airspace, the Air Force said on the ex-social media platform, describing the attack as the most intense affecting western Ukraine since July 8th. Lviv's regional governor, Maxim Kotyski, warned missiles were approaching Stryi, where gas transmission systems and storage infrastructure is located. An air raid alert, which started after midnight, was continued in about half of Ukraine after a brief intermission. The northwestern city of Lutsk, which has rarely been a target of attacks, was also affected, and a residential house was damaged, local mayor Ihor Poliszczuk said, according to Cisplatin broadcaster. At least three people were killed in the attack, according to local governments. The desire to destroy our energy will cost Russians dearly, Andriy Yermak, head of Zelensky's office, said on Telegram Monday. Several districts in Kyiv remained without power and water supply amid the attack due to the situation in the country's energy system, the city's mayor, Vitaly Klitschko, said on Telegram. Kotyski also said that the power supply was interrupted in Lviv region. Ukraine's grid operator imposed urgent power cuts. The country's energy minister, German Galushenko, said on Facebook, the situation is difficult and the consequences of the attack are being assessed. Meanwhile, the Russian Defense Ministry said 20 Ukrainian drones attacked targets overnight in several central regions of Russia. Two multi-story apartment buildings in the cities of Saratov and Engels were hit during the strike, according to Saratov regional governor Roman Busagar. Several people were injured, he said.
The purpose of the North Carolina Reading Service is to connect people who are blind and print impaired to each other and the community by delivering news, information, and entertainment using the latest audio technology. To receive more information, please visit our website, ncreadingservice.org, or give us a call at 919-832-5138. That's 832-5138. Can you be too old to drive in North Carolina? Here are some state guidelines for elderly drivers. Retirees typically have more free time to cruise the roads. But recent data show the number of older people involved in accidents is growing. From 2010 to 2019, there were 377,470 crashes involving drivers age 65 and older, which accounted for 15% of all crashes during that time frame, according to the North Carolina Department of Transportation. While two-thirds of those crashes involved property damage only, there were 2,675 fatalities that resulted from the incidents. NCDOT data also shows there was a 69% increase in the number of crashes among drivers aged 65 and older during that time period. Nearly half, 46%, of the older driver crashes occurred in North Carolina's top 10 counties, including Mecklenburg, Wake, and Durham, according to the DOT. Driving can be dangerous for older people because they can experience changes in their vision, hearing, mind, and physical fitness, according to ncseniordriver.org, a site managed by the UNC Highway Safety Research Center. Seniors are also more at risk for health conditions like arthritis, diabetes, dementia, Parkinson's disease, and stroke, which can all affect their driving. Are there restrictions in place that limit older drivers from driving? How old is too old to drive? Here's what the state law says. There is no age where you're considered too old to drive in North Carolina, but you will have to renew your license more often after you reach 66 years of age. The Division of Motor Vehicles requires people 66 or older to renew their license every 5 years, while people younger than 66 have to renew their licenses every 8 years. Aside from more frequent renewals, the Department of Motor Vehicle policies do not include any age-specific requirements or restrictions for obtaining a renewal. Where do requests for medical evaluations come from? Anyone can request a driver be medically evaluated by filling out a request form online, but requests are typically submitted to the department by doctors who notify the DMV about patients who they feel might be at risk to themselves or others. Law enforcement officers who observe drivers with poor driving habits related to health problems such as poor vision, slow reaction time, or reports of falling asleep. Wreck reports related to a medical condition that may have contributed to a motor vehicle accident. Involuntary commitment orders submitted by the court system. You can learn more by going to ncdot.gov/DMV. DMY, excuse me. ncdot.gov/DMV. Is driving at an older age more dangerous? Data shows that senior drivers make up a sizable chunk of those involved in fatal accidents. In 2022, 20% of all fatal crashes in the United States involved a driver age 65 or older, according to the most recent data available from the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. Some older drivers can be more prone to accidents. Insurance premiums are usually higher for drivers older than 75. The Insurance Information Institute suggests that fatalities and injuries involving older drivers are a result of their increased susceptibility to injuries and slower reflections and vision impairment. Even though this segment of drivers is significantly smaller than younger drivers, older drivers are keeping their licenses longer and driving more miles than ever before, the consumer-focused publication said. Are there signs that someone is losing their ability to drive? There are physical signs that can show that an elderly person is losing their ability. The National Highway Safety Council says changes in vision, physical fitness, and reflexes can cause safety concerns. Here are some of the signs that they say to look for that can weaken some driving visibility. Vision. You have problems reading highway and street signs or recognizing someone you know across the street. You have trouble seeing lane lines and other pavement markings, curbs, medians, other vehicles and pedestrians. Physical fitness. You have trouble looking over your shoulder to change lanes or looking left and right to check traffic at intersections. You have trouble moving your foot from the gas to the brake pedal or turning the steering wheel. You've fallen down, not counting a trip or stumble, once or more in the previous year. And finally, reflexes. You feel overwhelmed by all the signs, signals, and road marking, pedestrians, and vehicles that you have to pay attention to at an intersection. Gaps in traffic are harder to judge, making it more difficult to turn left at intersections or to merge with traffic. You take medications that make you sleepy. For a full list of all this stuff, you can go to the National Highway Safety, NHTSA.gov/older-drivers. NHTSA.gov/older-drivers.
I have trouble holding onto the steering wheel myself. It's slippery with all that chocolate I've been eating. All right, let's turn to some editorials and commentary columns. This one is an editorial by the NNO Editorial Board. It's entitled, North Carolina Supreme Court Tosses Fairness with Recusal Ruling. That the Supreme Court of North Carolina is little more than a Republican caucus has been clear for more than a year. Still, the court's ruling last week that Justice Philip Berger Jr. can sit in judgment of cases involving his father, State Senate Leader Philip Berger, is a stunning display of how the court's independence has curdled into arrogant partisanship. In a vote along party lines, the court voted to reject a request by Governor Roy Cooper that Justice Berger recuse himself in two cases. The most significant case is a challenge to a law that would strip the governor from controlling the administration of elections. The governor's appointment powers for state and local boards of election would be given to legislative leaders, including Senator Berger. The challenged law calls for membership of the state and local boards of elections to be evenly split between political parties, rather than giving the governor's party a majority. The change would invite deadlocks, whose resolution would be decided by the legislature. That would effectively put the legislature in charge of elections, despite the state constitutions assigning that authority to the governor. Republicans gained a 5-2 majority on the court after the 2022 elections, upending the 4-3 majority Democrats enjoyed on the previous court. Cooper's request to have Justice Berger removed was an act of hope over experience. Perhaps the governor thought that a ray of conscience or a clear reading of the law would persuade one of the Republican justices to admit the absurdity of a son sitting in judgment of his father. Berger the Younger deferred to his fellow justices to decide the matter, but that hardly brought an independent judgment. Following a tortured line of reasoning, the four remaining Republican justices found, in effect, that Senator Berger was not Justice Berger's father. Rather, they found that the senator is a disembodied legal entity who has been named in the lawsuit only in his official capacity as the Senate's president pro tem. This argument would be implausible in most cases, but particularly so in this one. Senator Berger has ruled the state Senate for 13 years and repeatedly imposed his will on his caucus since day one. He has aggressively sought to take power from the executive branch, even when a Republican, Pat McCrory, was governor. Senator Berger has presided over the most egregious gerrymandering in this nation and is now seeking to have the final word on the administration and perhaps the outcome of elections. He is directly and personally involved in pushing the disputed legislation. The Republican justices assure us that Berger will rule dispassionately on matters involving his father. We're supposed to believe that because, in another case, Berger said he would do so. The court's majority opinion says, in his order denying a similar recusal motion in another case, Justice Berger explained that the lawsuit was really against the state, not against his father, and that he was confident in his ability to discharge the duties of his office in a fair and impartial manner. We believe that Justice Berger Jr. can and will execute his responsibilities in this case fairly and impartially. The motion and suggestion of recusal is hereby denied. What's the state's top court? What the state's top court has actually denied is the North Carolina Code of Judicial Conduct. And, for good measure, it also ignored the 14th Amendment's requirement that legal matters be resolved through a fair process. In a dissent joined by the court's other Democrat, Justice Anita Earls, Justice Allison Riggs noted that the judicial code calls for a judge to disqualify himself or herself in a proceeding in which the judge's impartiality may reasonably be questioned. The code makes it clear that a case involving a judge's relative is such a proceeding. The Code of Judicial Conduct does not exempt a judge from recusal, even when their family member is a party in their official capacity, she wrote. Riggs said the code so settles the matter that she didn't need to argue how Berger's failure to step away from a case violates the 14th Amendment's guarantee of due process. In refusing to remove Justice Berger, the court's majority has instead removed any appearance of fairness.
Contributing columnist Gene Nickel, a professor of law at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, has an opinion article. Post-Democratic National Convention, I see possibilities for Democrats that I never imagined. Who would have thought 5 weeks ago the Democratic Party would produce a stunningly inspiring, decisive, organized, unifying, and mobilizing national convention? But who would have thought ever that Democrats could pull off a week like last week? I am, as always, a sucker for the speeches. Michelle Obama challenging the affirmative action of generational wealth, and wonder who's going to tell the other party's nominee the job he's currently seeking might be one of those black jobs. Or Barack Obama's hilarious hand gestures while describing Donald Trump's weird obsession with crowd size, and his warning that we all know the sequel is usually worse. And Democrat vice presidential nominee Tim Walz's reminder that while other states, like North Carolina, were banning books from their schools, we were banishing hunger from ours, and living out their golden rule, mind your own damn business. Who would have guessed that NBA and Olympic gold medal basketball coach Steve Kerr's simple assertion that leaders must display dignity, tell the truth, and care for and love the people they're leading would be so uniformly understood as a devastating bash on Donald Trump without ever mentioning the former president's name. Night-night. There were the great and impressive Tar Heels, though it's never acceptable to bounce James Taylor. The endless array of Republicans speaking of their venomous and dangerous former leader. And the magic of the Democratic nominees' families and extended families doing family values rather than talking them. And every father in the land gushing uncontrollably at the sight of Galt Walsh's exclamation, "That's my dad. Is he ever?" For many millions, including me, to now have Kamala Harris carry their banner as heirs of the greatest democracy in the history of the world, recognizing it's now our turn to do what generations before have done to fight for the country we love, is an infusion of pride and purpose and possibility we could not have sensibly expected. The Democratic Convention was an explosion of that Republican-detested word, diversity, a rising front in this century's greatest battle between the promises of pluralistic, multiracial, constitutional democracy and a burgeoning, racialized autocracy. The Milwaukee Journal reported 3% of delegates at the Republican Convention were black. Harris described November's election as not only the most important of our lives, but one of the most important in the life of our nation. There was, of course, much necessary talk of the rough and uphill road ahead, but the struggle for the meaning of America is cruising in an even broader sense. President Obama reminded, "No nation, no society has ever tried to build a democracy as big and as diverse as ours, one that includes people that, over decades, have come from every corner of the globe, one where our allegiances are defined not by race or blood, but by a common creed." Deeply diverse societies, perhaps unsurprisingly, often founder, brutalizing their most vulnerable members in ways that demolish the humanity of all. But none of us can actually welcome that or tolerate that. That's why my favorite promise of the week was Harris's closing one. "I will never waver in the defense of America's security and ideals because in the enduring struggle between democracy and tyranny, I know where I stand and where the United States belongs." Where the United States belongs.
From Rebecca Libaskos, who is a climate research specialist for the People for Ethical Treatment of Animals Foundation, comes this opinion column from the Tribune News Service, reprinted in today's NNO, "Embracing Wellness in the Digital Age." Remember the crinkle of the wrapper when opening a brand new CD? What about the comforting smell of a bookstore and the satisfying weight of a new paperback in your hands? These are the moments of non-screen joy that many of us hold dear as sacred childhood memories. It's no wonder that Gen Z is breathing life back into the vinyl, CD, Polaroid, and print book industries. We crave a connection to the physical world. In honor of National Wellness Month in August, let's take a step away from our screens and embrace the joy of unplugged activities. Let's use a digital detox to connect with and protect the planet and all its inhabitants. Experts found that excessive smartphone use can alter the brain, according to WebMD. Each scroll or swipe releases dopamine, affecting the same brain areas that respond to addictive drugs like cocaine. This can lead to increased stress, anxiety, and even depression. Logging off can do us good. So instead of scrolling social media, let's stroll with our animal companions or visit a nature preserve to appreciate animals in their natural homes. When it's time to eat, forget the meal delivery apps. Instead, visit your local farmer's market or grocery store for healthy vegan foods, including legumes such as lentils and chickpeas, nuts like almonds and walnuts, whole grains like quinoa and oats, and fruit like berries and avocados. Basing our meals around foods that, like these, can support mental health and overall well-being. A study in the journal Nutritional Neuroscience even suggests that going vegan might help reduce anxiety and stress. So why not feed your senses with a hearty lentil chili, creamy avocado pasta, or savory quinoa salad? Choosing healthy, sustainable, and compassionate foods also supports our mental wellness, because it empowers us to help curb the climate catastrophe and cruelty to animals. Every bite counts. The University of Oxford published a study that found that meatless sausages and burgers are up to 10 times more planet-friendly than their fleshy counterparts. The study evaluated greenhouse gas emissions, land use, and water stress. This should come as no surprise when we consider that animal agriculture pollutes air, water, land, ecosystems, and soil, while causing suffering and death to billions of vulnerable animals. In addition to enjoying vegan meals, we can opt for animal-friendly, screen-free entertainment by visiting an animal sanctuary. Ensure that it is accredited by the Global Federation of Animal Sanctuaries. Or by purchasing tickets to an animal-free circus. Instead of exploiting animals like elephants and tigers, these shows feature skilled human performers, such as tightrope walkers, trapeze artists, and jugglers, who consent to participate, something animals don't and can't do. Giving back to the community beats hours of scrolling through TikTok. Studies reveal that volunteering boosts happiness and life satisfaction. And participating in volunteer activities can build social connections and foster a deeper sense of purpose. Many animal shelters rely on volunteers to do laundry, clean kennels, and walk homeless animals. Or you could offer to walk a lonely dog whose guardian is away all day. These animals deserve attention, exercise, and friendship, too. When we unplug from our devices, we discover real connections and countless ways to make the world a better place.
Some wild horses mysteriously vanished for months on North Carolina's Outer Banks. Where did they go? A ghost of sorts appeared on the northern end of North Carolina's Outer Bank, a wild stallion that goes by the name Dash. The elusive horse came out of nowhere August 14th with his equally mysterious mom, Roder, confirming a lesser-known fact about the feral banker horses that live on Corolla. There are a handful of horses that we're lucky to see once or twice a year because they live deep in the marsh in places that are difficult or often impossible for us to access. Meg Puckett of the Corolla Wild Horse Fund wrote in a Facebook post, "The horses have about 7,500 acres of land to roam, and it's quite vast once you get away from the oceanfront. Easy for a couple of horses like Roder and Dash to stay hidden for months at a time. That's unexpected, given the Outer Banks are becoming increasingly crowded as an East Coast tourist destination. It's estimated over 5 million people a year visit the Outer Banks, including about 2.8 million drawn to the beaches and historic attractions at Cape Hatteras National Seashore in 2023. A herd of just over 100 wild horses roams the Corolla area, including some that have managed to stay hidden for years. In 2023, the Corolla Wild Horse Fund announced a secretive family of horses, two adults and a foal, was discovered living like castaways on an island in the sound, must be south, southwest of Corova Beach. We always assume there are probably a handful more that we never see," the fund wrote. "It isn't completely understood why some hermit horses suddenly show up on beaches and then just as suddenly disappear. Puckett says it could have to do with the disease-carrying horseflies that plague the islands when conditions are damp and hot. There comes a point when even the most stoic of wild horses can no longer stand the biting and head for beaches where coastal winds thwart the insects. That's likely what caused Dash and his mom to materialize on August 14th, Puckett said. I'm not really sure why there are some that don't come out of the marsh and wood very often, when the majority of them do go back and forth pretty regularly. Probably just behavior that has been passed down for many generations. I'd say there may be 10 to 15 that only come out around the houses and onto the beach a couple of times a year. And maybe half are even more elusive and lucky to see them once a year. Their disappearing acts prove a lot of wild habitat still exists on North Carolina's Barrier Island and the horses use it, she said. Either by instinct or by trial and error, they know how to find secret places that are too secret and too wet for humans. Development is definitely a huge issue and presents a lot of dangers to the horses. Development doesn't just mean houses going up and loss of habitat. It also means traffic, garbage, more septic system, and wells going in, more people in general, etc., Puckett says. But knowing that, there really is a lot of untouched habitat west of the dunes, and it really is so vast, there are horses that can disappear back into it for months at a time, helps you stay hopeful in the future. It's also a reminder of how wild these horses are and how capable they are of taking care of themselves in their natural habitat. To find out more about the nonprofit Corolla Wyhoe Funded Rescue Farm and Land Acquisition Fund, visit CorollaWildHorses.com.
This article is entitled Dean's List. It's a roundup of higher education news in the Triangle and across North Carolina from the NNO Observer. This week's edition includes more information about St. Aug's new loan and credit approval, UNC Chapel Hill's rules on protests, a new location for Wake Technical Community College, and more. So let's start with St. Aug's University. Last year was a turbulent one for St. Augustine University in Raleigh as the private historically black college faced threats to its accreditation and an ongoing list of financial issues. Now, though, the university says things could be looking up. The university last month received the news that its accreditation agency had reversed a decision to strip the university of its accreditation and membership with the agency. And Friday, the university announced it has been approved for a multi-million dollar line of credit, which will enhance the university's capacity to successfully commence the fall 2024 academic semester, albeit 2 weeks late. So, how will the university use the money, and which group is providing the money? Under St. Aug's agreement with Durham-based Gothic Ventures, a multi-class, multi-sector capital provider, the university has been approved for a line of credit of up to $30 million. The initial allocation, funded at the closing of the deal between the organizations, is for a loan of $7 million, leaving the possibility for the university to request more money in the future. The agreement is secured by a deed of trust on St. Aug's real estate holdings, a news release said. Interim St. Aug's president, Marcus Burgess, has previously cited the university's land as one of its most valuable assets. The partnership with Gothic Ventures marks a pivotal moment for SAU as it embarks on a multi-year strategic plan to stabilize and grow the university, St. Aug's Board of Trustees Chair Brian Boulware said in his news release. This funding secures our immediate needs while allowing us to implement our long-term vision. We believe our partnership with Gothic Ventures will be crucial to our journey toward excellence. The university plans to use the initial $7 million allocation to address critical short-term cash flow requirements, including funding an external audit of the university, refunding student credit balances, and settling missed and delayed employee payments. The university on several occasions within the past year has been unable to pay employees on time, which Burgess has attributed to a lack of available funds. To ensure a smooth transition, the university's external payroll agent will process all outstanding payroll sequentially, a news release said. Burgess said the loan and line of credit from Gothic represent a significant affirmation of our commitment to our students and staff. Classes will begin at St. Aug's for the fall semester on September 3rd. That's 2 weeks later than initially planned, with Burgess citing ongoing funding and maintenance issues and some damage caused by Tropical Storm Debbie. For more than a year after we left the U.S. Senate, former North Carolina Republican Senator Richard Burr is joining is joining the faculty at Duke University's Sanford School of Public Policy. Burr will be a Polis Distinguished Fellow, part of a program that brings accomplished political practitioners, public servants, and organizers to campus to engage with our community and dedicate some portion of their time to a project that promises an innovative solution to a problem of contemporary politics and that involves students in the process. During his term as a fellow, Burr will play an active role in the university's new Bridging the Divide initiative, which aims to foster dialogue between members of groups with differing political and ideological views. The first event of the initiative will be September 9th and will feature a conversation between Burr and Duke Provost Alec Gallimore. The start of a new academic year brought a new campus to the Triangle with the opening of Wake Technical Community College's East Campus in Wendell. The campus welcomed students to their classes for the first time on Thursday, which marked the first day of classes for all Wake Tech locations. Wake Tech East offers the following degrees: Associate in Arts, Associate in Science, Associate in Engineering, AAS Emergency Medical Science. More than 25,700 students are enrolled across Wake Tech this semester, making this the highest fall enrollment in the college's history. The number includes more than 8,500 new students, marking another record.
We've got a couple of things that happened on this date in history. In 1776, during the American Revolution, British forces, under General William Howe, defeated George Washington and the American Continental Army in the Battle of Long Island. 1928, the Kellogg Brand Pact was signed between France and the United States in a series of peacekeeping efforts after World War I. 1939, German Ernst Heinrich Heinkel, HE-178, a turbojet-powered aircraft, made the first jet flight. 1979, Louis Mountbatten, 1st Earl Mountbatten of Burma, was assassinated by members of the Provisional IRA Republican Army who put a bomb on his boat. And in 2008, Democrat politician Barack Obama became the first African-American to be nominated for presidency of either party. And that's it for our first hour. You've been listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, and this program is generously supported by the Orchid Group at Morgan Stanley.
Thank you, Orchid Group at Morgan Stanley.
That was short. All right. You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. We'll return to our broadcast shortly. Where are you, music?